Continuing our deep dive into the Electoral College, next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the host here on Principles and Policies. This is our show for April 13th, 2024. And those of you who've been paying attention, you may have noticed that there's no advertisement for the upcoming RUC banquet. Well, that's because the upcoming RUC banquet was last Tuesday, April the 9th. And I'm happy to report, as far as I know, this was a very successful banquet. However, we still need your donations. And I would ask you, first of all, if you don't know what it's all about, I did a radio show. It was March 30th, 2024. I did an interview with Catherine Wood, who's the executive director of Relationships Under Construction. And she's really the person who, she's the idea woman. She's the woman who has the vision. All us board members do is support what the things that she and her collaborators do. We do have a number of collaborators, but Catherine's the main cog in the machine. And if you want to know what Relationships Under Construction is about, we did a tour de force, sort of, on March 30th, and it's up on the website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com, and you can listen to that. It should play right in your browser, and listen to that. And once you listen to it, think about going out to the Relationships Under Construction website. That's RUCinc.org, RUCinc.org, or RelationshipsUnderConstruction.com. That's RelationshipsUnderConstruction.com, and donate. Become a monthly donor. And we do need that, but it was a great banquet. And for those of you who came out and heard about it on WLRY, we really appreciate you coming out. Mike O'Reilly told me that he did have some people come to the booth, the WLRY booth, and say that they had heard Catherine on WLRY, my interview with her. And I'll tell you what, she is a great person, and we really thank Mike and WLRY for coming out, and we thank Mike for the time that WLRY put in to give advertising to the banquet. We really appreciate it, and we appreciate all you out there in WLRY land, and those of you who listen to it on the podcast, we're deeply grateful for that as well. So, thank you very much for helping us at Relationships Under Construction. So now we resume our foray into the Electoral College. I've done two shows so far on this, and I hope this is the last one. I think it is. I am going to do some review. I'm going to go back to the first really true popular election of the president. And remember, before 1828, really, people considered the federal government, that was something that was that really didn't have anything to do with them unless they went to the post office or got drafted into military service, had their militia unit called up to be under federal control for a war or some defects invasion. You think about it. The last serious war that wasn't an internal conflict with natives or that kind of thing was in the War of 1812, which ended in 1815. And ironically, it ended with Andrew Jackson being the hero. And he's one of the main candidates in 1828. Well, what happened, why things changed so much in 1824, Andrew Jackson got squeezed out, despite the fact that he was the popular vote winner. He got squeezed out of the presidency by Congress. And we had talked about the fact that that was one of those places where there wasn't a clear majority, and Congress got to pick who got to be president. There were a number of deals that were made and that kind of thing. And Andrew Johnson got squeezed out in 1824 in favor of John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams only served one term. I'm not really sure he wanted to serve all that badly in that term. John Quincy Adams was a statesman. He was a great diplomat. He was not a bad president, unlike his father, John Adams, who was, in my opinion, a terrible president. John Adams gave us the Alien and Sedition Act, which essentially was a way to squash political opposition. John Adams is the kind of guy who they were trying to come up with a title to give the president of the United States. And John Adams had kind of kingly ambitions, and he wanted to be referred to as Your Highness or Your Eminence. George Washington would have had nothing to do with that. Your Excellency, something like that. How about Mr. President? And that's usually what we use nowadays, Mr. President. It's a sign of respect that the fact that the man has achieved the office. And there's a great scene in Band of Brothers. Maybe you've seen it. If you haven't, or haven't in a while, you can find this scene. Dick Winters, who's one of the central characters, has been promoted to major. He is a major by this time, as they're preparing to go to jump into Europe on D-Day. He has made it all the way to major. Why? Because he's a great officer. Flat out. He's a good tactician. He's a good leader of men. Men respect him. Men listen to him. And he is at a staging area, and he is confronted with his old training officer. He had been made executive officer under Captain Sobel, and played so well, by the way, by David Schwimmer, who did a great job. Schwimmer did a great job being the guy you love to hate. But one of the lines in there, not to get too much, I'm not doing a movie review for Band of Brothers. What I'm talking about is that Captain Sobel, who's, I believe, at the time still a captain, has been relegated to training operations because apparently he is a great training officer. He's a terrible leader of squadrons and battalions and things. Can't read a map, can't do anything. Captain Sobel walks past Major Winters, who's sitting in a Jeep, and fails to salute. That's a no-no in the military. When you're outside and everyone's in full uniform, you are required to salute a superior officer. And Dick Winters calls him out for it, and he says, Captain Sobel, we salute the rank, not the man. Knowing full well that Sobel hated him. Sobel hated him. And that I think that statement says it all. We salute the rank, not the man. You can hate someone who's in office. Nonetheless, you owe them respect because they have the job. This is a biblical principle. That doesn't mean that you don't do everything you can on a bad leader. And if you recall that show, they did a lot of things to get that he got relegated to training because he was such a bad leader, and he was so bad that the sergeants of the platoon, who had been brought up in the ranks, they all started out as private first class, and brought through corporal through sergeant, they all quit en masse. And there was talk of court-martialing them and all that stuff. Nonetheless, you salute the rank, not the man. And this is not just in the U.S. military. It's in our you refer to the president, you may say, call him names behind his back, but to him, if I were to meet Joe Biden tomorrow, I would refer to him as Mr. President. Because he's got the office. Whether I like him or not, there are people who sit in the in different office. I don't particularly like my House of Representatives member. But if I were to meet him face to face and talk to him, I would treat him with respect. Why? Because he has the office. So what's this all about? This is going back to John Adams was not a very good president. He liked to lord it. I mean, this is a guy who decided that he should be seen in public wearing a sword on his, you know, on his hip. Okay, fine. To indicate that he's commander in chief of the, and remember, constitutionally, the president's commander in chief. But this is something that I heard my father say once, and it stuck with me, that there are certain people who demand more respect than they command. And John Adams demanded more respect than he commanded. Now, was he a brilliant man? Yes. Was he necessarily a really bad leader? No, but he forgot himself when he got in power. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. In the presidential elections, you don't want a man who will forget himself when he gets into power. Just remember that George Washington, the first president, didn't want to serve in either one of his two terms. He did not want the job. But he knew in order to get the republic up and running and on its feet, he would have to do the job because he was so unanimously respected. And there's a man who did not demand respect. He commanded respect. Everyone respected George Washington. Was he flawed? Of course he was flawed. There are things that I'm critical about him for, but this is, you think back in the Bible, what did David do when he was being chased around under the threat of murder by Saul? Did he call him names? Did he do whatever he could to give him a hot foot? No, he tried to stay away from him. And in the incident in the cave where he cut off a corner of his garment while Saul went into the cave to relieve his needs, he met up with David, and David handed him the corner off his robe, and Saul understood what was being said. Saul understood that David was saying, I respect you, I wouldn't harm a hair on your head, here is the corner of your garment to prove to you that I showed you the deepest respect. The deepest respect is not surrendering to a tyrant so you can be murdered. The deepest respect is staying away from the tyrant so that you can continue your life and, yes, be in opposition to him. Yes, loyal opposition. That means that you would come to the aid of that tyrant if it became absolutely necessary. What did David do? David knew that God was going to take him out at some point. He just didn't know when, because David had already been anointed king, but he was not yet acclaimed into the office. What does that mean, acclaimed in the office? In biblical times, the way you got to be king, and the way actually you get got to do it in England, and our closest experience in this kind of thing, there were people who were awarded the crown by nobles, but were not acclaimed by the people. In other words, were not accepted as king by the people, and so they didn't rule. Lady Jane Grey had this problem after the death of Edward the I get mixed up on all these Edwards. Edward the Fifth, I think, the son of Henry Tudor, Henry the Eighth. After he died, he had left a succession request that Lady Jane Grey, who was his cousin, come in and take the throne. That was to keep Mary Queen of Scots off the throne, or Mary Queen of Scots, Mary Tudor, not Mary Queen of Scots, Mary Tudor, his sister, who was a Catholic. This was a Catholic Protestant. Lady Jane Grey was a very devout Protestant, and Edward was a very devout Protestant, and he wanted his sister to come in and take the office. Well, Lady Jane Grey was the nobles, a number of the nobles elevated her, but she was never acclaimed, and other nobles came in and undermined her, and eventually Mary came to the throne, and because a Lady Jane Grey, who, by the way, was only about 17 years old, so she would have come in with a regent, that is, a noble who would have run the things of the kingdom until Jane Grey, Queen Jane, would have been able to run things on her own, much as Elizabeth and Mary did. Remember, Elizabeth is another sister of Edward, the older sister than him, but younger than Mary. Okay, Lady Jane Grey was not acclaimed. Therefore, she did not actually become queen. She's not counted as a queen, even though she was a queen. There are others in English history who were, one guy ruled for a year, and he was never really acclaimed as king. You may not know about King Louis. You may never have heard of the English King Louis. That's because he's not on the list of kings. Okay, that being said, going back to this. During, I've confused the issues, and I didn't want to do that. Okay, so let's get back to it. Get back off the rabbit trail. In the elections of 1824 and 1828, we see an explosion of popular voting. People are getting away from the idea that the federal government, it really is a government of governments, and that is the basis of federalism, actually, that the federal government is a government that really shouldn't touch the people. It should touch the states. It operates on behalf of the people, but it really represents the states. Now, since obviously we elect members of the House of Representatives to sit in that government, that is a place where the people are supposed to have contact with the federal government, and not through the executive and not necessarily through the Senate. It's very poorly understood, and it went away really in 1913, I think, when the amendment, the 17th Amendment passed, that made senators popularly elected rather than by the choice of the states. There were a number of senators, Senate states, who chose to elect their senators by popular vote, but there were still a number of states who chose, because the Senate is supposed to be the place where the state governments are represented. Okay, the Senate is the seat of the state governments in the federal government. This is federalism. Those of you out there who are Presbyterian, who understand your form of government, this is very similar to a Presbyterian form of government. You have a General Assembly, you have a presbytery, and you have local congregations. Local congregations do most of the ruling internally for themselves. When there are rules that all of the churches in a particular area should be adhering to, that is taken care of by the presbytery. And then there are rules that are followed by all the presbyteries. Then that is done by the General Assembly. Those changes to the general operation of the church, do those have effects on the presbyteries and the local congregations? Well, of course it does. just as anything that happens at the federal government affects the state, the local, and the individual. But again, the federal government wasn't supposed to touch the individual much, and the General Assembly and the Presbyterian Church doesn't touch the people that much. How are delegates to the General Assembly chosen? Well, they're elected partly by, for instance, our denomination, our congregation, I'm sorry, I misspoke there. Our congregation would choose a delegate to go to the General Assembly. There are a set number of, you can't just show up. It's not like the Southern Baptist Convention, because that's not really a church government. It's a convention. And what that means is they set rules for all the churches in the conventions or within the boundaries of the convention, but it's not really a representative style government. It's a little more difficult to understand. We have a very regular order in the Presbyterian Church. You may have the phrase decently in an order in 1 Corinthians 14:39-40 says, "So, my brothers, earnestly desire to prophesy and do not forbid speaking in tongues, but all things should be done decently and in order." What does he mean? He's talking in context of a church service. But, of course, that extrapolates out to everything. Everything should be done decently and in order. You can't have chaos ruling when you're trying to get anything done. What would it be like if you went to a construction site and, well, we don't have a blueprint. We don't have a real plan. All we've got is this stack of raw materials. Okay, boys, have at it. Build something. How big? It doesn't matter. If you run out of raw materials, we'll get you more. No, you don't do that. You have an engineer draw up or an architect draw up a drawing. You order specific raw materials for a specific job. You hire men who know what they're doing. You hire skilled tradesmen who can guide those who are less skilled or, don't necessarily have, who can do jobs that don't require a whole lot of skill. Nonetheless, everybody's got a hierarchy. You can't turn those unskilled guys loose and just put up the framing for the roof. No, you got to have skilled tradesmen that can do that. Men who are trained, men who have done it for years, and who are busy training the guys who don't know what they're doing, so that later on they can become the skilled tradesmen. Okay, we do things decently in an order in a church and in government. Okay, that's the whole point in that. I mean, you have to do things decently in an order. So one of the reasons you have certain ways you do government and how they affect different people, it's written out in rule books. And we have a rule book regarding elections, and it became clear. It was clear at the beginning of the Republic that the federal government was a government of governments, not a government of people necessarily. The people have a say, as I pointed out earlier, in the House of Representatives, but they don't run it directly. Although, constitutionally, the House of Representatives has the most power. Isn't that interesting? The group that really has the most power in Congress but is touched the least, supposedly, theoretically and by design, with what has to do directly with the people. Why is that? The House of Representatives is there to keep the federal government off the people's back. Has that been the way it operates? I put that question to you, and you can go out to principledpolicy.com and go to chairman@principledpolicy.com, send me an email, and tell me what you think. But the House of Representatives has been very busy in the last 150 years or so in placing more burdens on the back of the people rather than keeping the federal government off their back. Okay, now, in the executive branch, the president is supposed to have very, very, very little to do with touching the lives of the of the people. That's why there wasn't a popular vote up until 1824, when all of a sudden we had an explosion, because the as we talked about in earlier shows, the attitude about government changed. It went from liberty, the idea of liberty, that is keeping the federal government off the people's back, to the idea of democracy, in that, oh, well, we can get, you know, we can get the federal government to do this and this and this and this for us. You kind of see that at the local level, in places where, for instance, the local governments will come in and say, we need your property for a public work. Well, really, what they want your property for, you know, sometimes they need it for a public work, a road or whatever. But sometimes what they do is they'll take your property for a quote-unquote public work and hand it over to a developer who takes your property and turns it into something that brings more revenue into that governmental entity. That's not the design of government, folks. You're supposed to be protected from that. Okay. That's the spirit of democracy, believe it or not. Because in the spirit of liberty, that would never be allowed to happen. But our spirit of democracy has taken over our governments. Okay. And remember this, election procedures and eligibility of voters began to change, reaching really a peak in 1828. Only two states had no popular vote for president. So we're up to 20-some states by this time. About 1,148,000 people cast popular votes in 1828. That's a lot. That's a large percentage of the population. Of course, women still could not vote. In some states, women, this is a myth, and women could vote if they were head of household. For instance, they're a widower and they're running their husband's business. Especially in the colonial period, women did vote in local elections because they were running their homes and they were running their late husband's businesses. It was a one family, one vote concept. All right, we've gotten away from that in the spirit of democracy. It's become one man, one vote, rather than one family, one vote. The election of 1828 is really the turning point. It's the place when it all changed. Political parties suddenly that came into being. Now, this is how fast things can happen. Even in the early 19th century, the political parties came into being really between the elections. They came into their full-on power and glory between 1824 and 1828. Now remember, this is 1824 was when Andrew Jackson got squeezed out for president, despite being the popular vote winner, the hero of New Orleans, the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. By the way, after the treaty for the War of 1812 was already signed, supposedly bringing the war to an end. Okay. Political parties are now in full control of presidential elections at the state and federal level. They're in control. Before that, the parties were simply factions under which people organized. Now they're political entities, like we have now. Parties now pander to and try to manipulate popular opinion. Folks, doesn't matter which party you're a member of. Parties now pander to and try to manipulate popular opinion. You can't deny this. Emotional issues begin to dominate presidential politics. Exactly. We it's not policy issues. It's emotional issues. Now, are policy issues occasionally tied into these emotional issues? Sure. That's unavoidable as well. Some policy issues become emotional issues. Abortion is both a policy issue and an emotional issue. What's the emotional issue? People get very upset when you want to mess around with taking away their right to kill their infant. Vice versa, people get very upset when you try to hand the federal government or the state government or local governments the keys to the kingdom and say it's okay to kill your baby. That evokes a lot of emotion, but the fact is, what does the policy aspect of that have to do with? Well, we don't think in these terms anymore, but what policy do you think God would favor? Not allowing the murder of the unborn or allowing the murder of the unborn. Now, I've just had discussions with people who think God is on their side for allowing abortion. The logic is stilted and wrong. Nonetheless, they make the arguments, and the arguments are terrible, by the way. But these emotional issues can tear us apart, and you see the Republican Party right now. The Democrats have gone full on, let's kill all the babies we can all the time, anytime we want to. And Republicans are sort of we had Donald Trump come out and say, well, we need exceptions. And we'll do this on another show, why that's a myth. Nonetheless, and I've talked about it before on previous shows. You can find those. Look in our archives, principledpolicy.com, those show archives, and you can listen through, and usually the title gives you a clue about what I'm going to talk about. Okay, so in 1828, the parties are manipulating and using emotional issues. Demagogic politicians, if you don't know what that means, politicians who are willing to, get out there and whip up popular support. Well, these guys are whipping up regional disagreements into major policy splits. And by the way, this is the reason we got the Constitution, was because there were major statewide disagreements. There were states that had, for instance, seaports, and states that did not, and the states that had seaports were lording it over those who did not and forcing them to pay import and export duties, even though they were under the Articles of Confederation and were considered to be a federation, and supposedly that was going to be handled. Well, one of the reasons we got the Constitutional Convention was because of these tariffs. They wanted an interstate commerce clause in the Articles of Confederation, and they called the convention of 1787 to fix that. So what happened? I've done other shows on this. The whole process was hijacked and turned into a new constitution. Okay. Demagogic politicians are whipping up these regional disagreements. Political campaigns under control of party machines create increasingly strident and dirty campaigns. The presidential campaign of 1828 becomes one of the nastiest campaigns in presidential history. Andrew Jackson was especially... Now, he was not past making a political insult at all. I mean... in very salty and colorful language, nonetheless. Andrew had a voluminous vocabulary in curse words, according to all who knew him. But things were said about his wife because he had married a woman who he thought was a widow, and it turned out her husband was still alive. He'd been declared dead, and it turned out he was still alive. So a big deal was made out of the fact that, and honestly, the stress probably killed her. And Andrew Jackson was deeply resentful of the men who had hounded, well, as far as he was concerned, had hounded his wife to her death. Do we have nasty campaigns now? Oh, you bet we do. it's a thing that happens when we went from the elector system, the Liberty system, to Democratic popular vote. Now, in the past, before 1828, the men chosen as electors used to be independent thinking men interested in choosing whom they believe will be the best president, the best chief executive officer of the United States. And they've become party operatives. And look, I've served on an electoral slate. I didn't get chosen, but I've been on an electoral slate. I was a party operative. Don't kid yourself. I was a party operative with the party's interest as their chief concern. Now, I would say that those of us who were on the electoral slate for our party were not for the party's interest as our chief concern, but nonetheless, party mattered to us. Most states now have popular voting, general ticket voting, for all president with the highest vote getter getting all of the state's electoral votes, rather than the winner of each individual congressional district vote. There are two states that do it another way. They're both thinking of chucking that system, and I begged and pleaded, please don't chuck that system. Award electoral votes on the basis of congressional districts, with the Senate representatives getting the popular vote. Okay? You would see vastly different outcomes, I think, for the better, with that system, rather than just 2 out of 50. You know, 4% of the states doing it that way. Nebraska and Maine are both thinking about chucking that system. Nebraska's talking about a winner-take-all, and Maine is talking about this monstrosity called national popular vote. You may have heard of it. You may not understand what it is. Basically, that states that adopt national popular vote award their electors not on the basis of their state's popular vote, but on the popular vote of the country. It's a really horrific idea. It really disenfranchises completely, winner take all in the states completely disenfranchises rural voters versus urban voters already. It doesn't completely disenfranchise them, but it really, really, really strips them of power. Going to a national popular vote, I have a feeling that the first state that awards a national popular vote to a state that voted for the other candidate, they award their electors on the basis of national popular vote when their state voted the other way, there's going to be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Okay, so we now know that most states now have popular voting with that system. Between 1789 and 1828, the rapid philosophical shift that we talked about, liberty to democracy, essentially the nation's religious foundation. Now, this is interesting. It goes this way, and I sort of touched on this earlier, and don't take it beyond where I was going with it. The nation's religious foundation shifts from a strong Reformed theological influence to a strong Enlightenment Unitarian influence. In other words, Unitarianism is that Christ is not actually God, and the Holy Spirit is not God, just the Father. The Christ is an important a spiritual leader and a teacher. Are the most important divinely inspired teacher, and the Holy Spirit is kind of ignored. God is no longer sovereign, and enlightened man is now sovereign under that viewpoint. So, hence the increase in popular voting. The election of 1828 and the fundamental changes to the way people think about and the way states choose electors is the first step in dismantling federalism. That's what I've been about all this time. We are dismantling federalism. We're basically blending state, local, federal governments into one thing, and with instead of the federal government being at the bottom of the heap regarding power, they're now at the top of the pile. Yes, were the states required to do certain things? Yes, they were. How did that work and why? Because their power was constitutionally limited. Little by little by little, the Constitution has been put to the side, ignored, reinterpreted to say that, no, the federal government's on top. All federal laws supersede state laws and local laws. Yeah, that's true. If, remember, 9th and 10th Amendments, if the power is delegated to the federal government. And that's the problem. A lot of the power that the federal government has usurped is delegated to the states and to the people, respectively. The 10th Amendment is very clear. The power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, or reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. What does that mean? That's 10th Amendment to the Constitution. Basically, the forgotten amendment. The other one is the 9th enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So in other words, you can't just come in and say something's not a right. You have to prove it, essentially. That being said, we have fundamental changes to the way people think. Fundamental changes to the way people are trained in school. Federalism is a uniquely Republican system which can be described as divided sovereignty. Who's it divided amongst? It's divided amongst the state, the federal government, the state government, the local governments, the people. Each individual of civil government has specific areas of jurisdiction that the others cannot encroach on. But each of these smaller units of civil government voluntarily agrees to delegate some of their authority to the higher authority for the good of the smaller unit. The original intent of the Constitution is for a federal republic. The genius of the American Republic is that it is both representative and federal, as we talked about earlier. Yes, it's supposed to be a government of governments, but the people have a say in it because we get to elect a House of Representatives. All the units of government are represented in the higher units they have helped to create. So if you ever hear the argument that this is the stupidest argument I've ever heard. I'm sorry for being so blunt. The federal government created the states. No, the federal government did not create the states. The states were individual colonies. They got together and formed the federal government through the Articles of Confederation. And then there were other agreements between colonies before independence. Strong objections to representation in presidential choices bills. The country divides along regional, economic, and philosophical lines. And we talked about last week, the election of 1860, the vote was really split up. Abraham Lincoln only got 40% of the popular vote. Bill Clinton only got a 43%, in 92. You hear about all these people who were, popularly elected. Yeah, no, they weren't. They were elected by the Electoral College. The election of 1876 comes not too long after, 16 years after 1860. Most corrupt election in American history by far. We talked about this last week. Major fraud on both parties. What it led to, though, was really bad. The Congress basically moved in and usurped, rather than sending the problems back to the states to be fixed and then having them return their legitimate electors to vote for president. They formed a commission and basically seized, Congress formed a commission and seized that power. And elected Rutherford B. Hayes, who served one term, and threw out Samuel Tilden, who most assuredly won that election. This calls into question, you know, they really did a number on the Electoral College. They undermined it, knocked some of the pins out of the foundation of the Electoral College. So why does the Electoral College really matter, and why the purpose of the Electoral College is to provide proportional representation? What do I mean by that? Proportional representation. That means that it doesn't matter where you live, you are represented in the Electoral College vote if your state awards Electoral College votes by congressional district, the way it's supposed to be done. That means it doesn't matter how everybody around you votes. What matters is the way your district votes. And districts hold a great deal in common over, we hold in Licking County in our congressional district, which covers, I think, Licking, Muskingum, not maybe part of Knox. Now, we have more in common here than we do with people in Cuyahoga County. That's flat out. And yet people from Cuyahoga County can counter my vote because the cities in this state are where the population centers are, and they can all get together and vote one party while the rural voters vote another party. And they get overwhelmed. That's the whole point. If you concentrate people in a certain area, let's talk about there's an interesting election in 1880. In 1880, Grover Cleveland lost the election. Now, if you know anything about Grover Cleveland, he's the only president to serve a split term. He was elected in, let me get my facts straight. I think he was elected in 1880. Okay. And that's fine. He was elected in 1880. In 1884, he lost. And he lost, here's the way he lost. This is very interesting. This has to do with voting blocks. This is why you don't award electoral votes on necessarily on majority votes of the state. You do it by congressional district. In 1884, Grover Cleveland won by very small margins in the North. He maybe 50.2 to 49.8, those kind of margins, and he won in places all over the North. In the South, by the way, in 1884, Cleveland lost, as I mentioned. So he lost by tiny, tiny margins in the North. Tiny, tiny. The country was very closely divided. He lost by tiny, but in the South, it was overwhelming victory. And the solid South voted 70, 80, 90% for Grover Cleveland. So he had this huge abundance of popular votes. Well, Grover Cleveland lost that election. Had it been national popular vote, he would have been president. But in fact, what had really happened was the overwhelming, his huge number of popular votes in the South would have overwhelmed all the votes in the North. But they didn't do it that way. They did it by the Electoral College. So it still worked, even though it was broken at that point in most states. It still worked. It worked to keep these giant Democratic overvotes. When I say Democratic, small d, Democrat, even though Grover Cleveland was a Democrat, small d, Democratic overwhelming votes didn't overwhelm those tiny margins in the North. This is why we need to go back to the system where it's awarded by congressional district. Now, in the South, Grover Cleveland probably would have won most of the congressional districts. Most. Not necessarily all, but most. And that's not necessarily the point. Point is that in order to not overwhelm certain places, you have to have these safeguards to keep... this is like places that have a seawall. Think about New Orleans. Now, don't go back to Katrina because it failed. And it failed because of a number of reasons. But think about a seawall. You put up a seawall to keep these overwhelming floods from coming in and going over the top and flooding your city or flooding your whole coastline. That's exactly what the purpose of the Electoral College is. It's to act as a seawall to keep these giant surges from inundating you. Okay. This is proportional representation. You're represented in your person, in your local district. It's the basis of the creation of the U.S. Constitution. The whole point behind the Constitution is proportional representation. You don't throw together a slate of candidates. I forget how many representatives we have now. Is it 17 or 18 in Congress in Ohio? You don't just throw together 17 candidates and say, here, throw it to the whole state and say, here, vote for these. No, we do it by congressional district. Why is that? Proportional representation. We get to elect the representatives we like, not the ones that they like in Cleveland or Youngstown or Toledo or Dayton or Columbus or Cincinnati. That's the whole point. If we just did a dead slate, you would find Congress full of those people, the people from the other high voter density district places would do all the choosing. Okay, small states have equal representation on the basis of their populations to the larger states. Yes, they have fewer representatives. Nonetheless, they each get representation. That wasn't the original plan, by the way. When they went to the Constitutional Convention, the big states wanted to squeeze the little states out. In other words, they wanted to make the problems that were already existent worse. Luckily, that was not allowed. Now, this keeps the larger states from overwhelming the smaller states in Congress and in choosing of a president. The purpose of the Electoral College is to provide proportional representation. As mentioned, rural areas of states have equal representations. Keep the more liberal cities from running unchecked over the more conservative countryside in Congress and in the election of a president. All you have to do is look at electoral maps, folks. Look at some of those electoral college maps. And they will show you that the concentrations of votes for more liberals are concentrated around cities. The concentrations of more conservative candidates are out in the country. We really are not one big happy nation. We are strongly divided people, and we're becoming more and more divided because people are rigging up ways to reduce our representation in government. That's the whole move behind National Popular Vote. Now, according to National Popular Vote, in choosing a chief executive, as we explained, representation of voting minority interests should not count. In other words, let's broom out the minority. They really don't have a say. We're going to go with whatever the majority says. Direct democracy should be the only criteria. This is what they believe. The National Popular Vote people believe in direct democracy. Folks, direct democracy is easy to refute. Direct democracy is a lynch mob. The vote is 15 to 1 to lynch the person that's been caught. the one vote coming being, of course, the person. Now, in our justice system, that's not the way that works. You have to go through a trial by jury. And the, yes, does the jury vote to give you the death penalty? They can, but they also have to listen to the evidence. A lynch mob does not bother with the evidence. They think they know the answer. They string the person up and kill them. Okay, the framework of national popular vote. The individual states adopt legislation to implement it. It does not take effect until enough states are committed to ensure 270 electoral votes. Once that threshold is triggered, then every one of the national popular vote states' electoral votes will go to the presidential candidate with the most popular vote nationwide, as I explained. The popular vote of the voters of the states themselves will not count except as it regards the national totals. So the system is broke. Is the system broken beyond repair? No, the Electoral College still performs a useful function. 2000, I got the date wrong on Grover Cleveland. It's 1888. 1888, 1824 elections. The popular vote winner did not get a majority of the electoral votes. You can add in 2016 in that. We're ignoring 1876 because it is so fraud laden and such an unusual circumstance and so terrible that we're just going to ignore that. In these elections, regional factionalism and population concentration did not guarantee electoral college majorities. That's what it's supposed to do. The majority were not able to tyrannize the minority, and the federal nature of the system prevailed. Remember what federalism is. It's a combination. It's divided sovereignty. Family, local, state, federal government. Divided sovereignty. That's the federal nature. The system is broken, but definitely repairable. Now, I have a modest proposal for repairing the Electoral College and making it work like it's designed. Work in state legislatures, and remember, I'm not asking the feds to take this over. It's a bad plan. It's what people have been working for years who want to consolidate power in Washington, D.C. Work in state legislatures to choose electors like Nebraska and Maine already do, and remember, I said they're trying to chuck those systems. And there are reasons for that that have nothing to do with the fairness of the system. By congressional district, the two senatorial electors are awarded to the popular vote. This will make the system more federal and give equal weight to rural votes. City voters could no longer overwhelm the countryside vote. And again, you can see, I found maps. And of course, I can't show you a map. I'm on the radio. I've got them in front of me. Nonetheless, this proposal would break the stranglehold that the two major parties have on presidential elections. And that's what we really need to do, folks. We really need to break the stranglehold of the two parties. Am I registered with a specific party? Yes, I am, but only because it comes more closely to following my general opinion and ideas about how government should work. Than the other one does. It would allow third parties or independents a reasonable shot at the office of president. I don't know how many... I've worked in third-party politics. We really need to think about allowing these guys at least a shot. It would probably throw elections to the House of Representatives, and that's true. And these let me tell you, the cowards in the House of Representatives want nothing to do with this. They would really rather be boiled in oil and covered with feathers than have to do that. But it would do that. It would reinvigorate the legislative branch, which is good, and de-emphasize the executive branch. Folks, that's where we are. The Congress has been giving power to the... To the executive branch for far too long, going on 200 years. It would tend to increase the caliber of men chosen to be president, and I firmly believe that. It would reduce the influence of emotional issues in presidential politics, and it would reduce other Democratic pressures for bread and circuses. Well, okay. You know what I think, and I want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join me again next week for another Principles and Policies.